So I want to talk a bit about just carrying on a bit from that preliminary admonition where the Buddha asks us as a preparation to listen to the perfection of wisdom, or to open up to the perfection of wisdom. He asks us to call forth as much as we can of love, of reverence, of faith, to remove the defilements and the taint that cover us from reality, and to really listen to this teaching, which is for the benefit of the world, and which is for the heroic people who are prepared to really overcome difficulties. What is is there a sort of one practice that you could sort of boil that down to? Because that would be nice, wouldn't it? That more than nice, that would be very good. And of course, you need lots of practices. But I really do want to emphasise the practice of metta-bhavana in relation to this, the development of universal, boundless loving kindness. The reason for that is that metta is, as Sangharakshita says, the fundamental positive, skillful, emotional response. It's the basis for all responses, really. You know, metta is our basic, what we're looking for, our basic empathic response to all life is metta, is this clean, clear, loving kindness that really wants the very best for whoever we come into contact with. And we also know that in doing that, that's the very best for ourselves as well. But metta, when you're in touch with that sort of basic friendliness, loving kindness, when you encounter that which is greater, immediately it becomes faith, devotion, reverence. You don't even have to think about it. Metta is so tuned up, so sensitive to what's in front of it, as it were, that immediately it will become this quality of reverence and faith. But it also takes away defilements. Metta it can be sort of presented as an elementary practice, but it isn't really. Metta in the end is a wisdom practice, because one of the things that you're doing when you practice metta-bhavana is to see the other person, to see life, see the other person as they are in themselves. This is really important quality with metta. You're seeing the person stripped of your own desires and cravings and aversions. You're seeing them as they are in themselves. It's a very, very difficult thing to do, actually. But that's what you're training yourself to do in the metta-bhavana practice. You're really learning to see the person without the sort of taint of what they can do for you, how you can use them, as it were. You know, so often our love in a way is like that. We think it's love, but very often it's really bound up with what we want the other person to be for us. Metta is this tremendous feeling of love and goodwill and well-wishing, but we're not concerned with what they do for us. We see them as they are in themselves. So Sangharakshita talked about this in relation to the perfection of wisdom itself. He said that seeing with wisdom is actually seeing with metta. And in the commentary he did on this here at Pamaloka back in the 1970s, there's this wonderful moment in the seminar where you can see him almost thinking in the moment, where he reflects on a particular translator who died some years ago, a translator named Herbert V. Gunter. And Herbert Gunter had some very unusual translations of Buddhist terminology. So he didn't translate prajna as wisdom. He translated it as analytical appreciative discrimination. Whoa. Or he translated vidya, another word for wisdom, as aesthetic appreciation. So in both of them, there's this word aesthetic. And Sangharakshita really picked up on this word aesthetic. It's not meant in a sort of precious aesthete kind of way. It means seeing the other stripped of utility. And Sangharakshita made a distinction between seeing things aesthetically and seeing things in terms of in a utilitarian way. He talked about an experience he had in when he was living in Kalimpong of seeing this magnificent, beautiful, towering pine tree. And he exclaimed, "What a wonderful tree." And the friend he was with said, "Yes, this will keep us in firewood for the whole winter." And he contrasted the two ways of seeing. He was just stunned by the beauty of this tree. His friend was seeing it as firewood. In other words, seeing what it could do, for him. And this is really this is much closer to wisdom, seeing things in terms of metta, seeing the person as they are, seeing life as it is, seeing aesthetically. That's much closer to wisdom and seeing things as they are than seeing things, as it were, analytically and seeing how you can use them and what they can do for you. Sangharakshita pushed it a bit further, this sort of idea of seeing aesthetically, because he said, when you're doing the metta bhavana, when you get deeply into it, perhaps even if you don't get that deeply into it, you see others as beautiful. So it's a really, really important aspect of the practice, not brought out perhaps sufficiently, but when you meditate on the other person, you don't just say, like a record that's got stuck, maybe happy, maybe well, maybe happy, maybe well. No, you're really trying to take the other person in your mind. You're really trying to see them. And you're trying to look much, much more deeply than your usual habitual responses are. And eventually you reach a point where not only do you see your friend as beautiful, you not only see even the neutral person and the enemy as beautiful, it widens to the whole of life itself. And there's even descriptions in the Pali Canon where the Buddha says that where metta bhavana leads is to a liberation, a formless liberation called the beautiful. The beautiful is quite a mysterious state, that through metta you arrive at a liberation, an entry into the truth, into reality, called the beautiful, kind of pure beauty. Once somebody came to the Buddha and said, "Is it, what do you teach? I've heard that you teach that if you enter the liberation called the beautiful, you see everything as ugly." And the Buddha says, "No, I don't teach that. When you've entered the liberation called the beautiful, you know what beauty is. You know what beauty is. You know what, where beauty lies." So this is much closer to what the perfection of wisdom is getting at. Seeing people, seeing life, freed of your self-interest, free of your grasping. If we ever get to the text, the main part of the text, you'll see again and again and again, it says that the bodhisattva does not see things in terms of grasping. There's no sort of grasping. There's no clinging to ideas about what life is like. There's none of that. Things are seen as they are. So it says, Sangharakshita says, the bodhisattva lives almost in two worlds which coincides. He lives in what he called the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation. This vast sort of circle where he sees everything as beautiful, as pure. He sees with love, sees with compassion, sees people as they are, as living and growing beings with the potential for enlightenment. And he lives within that, in the lesser circle, the lesser sphere, or the lesser mandala of utility. This is the world where, of course, you have to get things done. You have to go to work, you have to earn a living, you have to run Buddhist centres, you have to organise things so that people can come together like this. You have to pay the bills, the cook has to do the cooking. But it's all happening within this bigger sphere, this much deeper, wider, more profound sphere of aesthetic appreciation. This is what wisdom really means. This is what the perfection of wisdom is really all about. So this is why it's said that the bodhisattva's activity is called lila, play. We speak of the bodhisattva lila. You'll see, if you ever met a bodhisattva, you'd see that they're tremendously sort of active in benefiting people. in working for the good of the Dharma, in working to improve people's lives in all sorts of ways. And wow, they work so hard. They do so much. But if they really are a bodhisattva, they won't see it like that. It will be play. It will be fun. It will be the natural expression of what they see, of their being, if you like. So you get this sort of language in Mahayana Buddhism of play, the bodhisattva play, or in Tantric Buddhism you have this term sahaja, which means something like natural, spontaneous. A lot of the time when people use the language of natural and spontaneous, actually they mean the reactive. And, you know, they think that's the sort of spontaneous creative life. But real spontaneity comes from seeing much, much more deeply. You know, seeing people as they are, not seeing them as, you know, faceless, you know, people, you know, faceless things that you can use to get ahead. But you see them as they really are, as living and growing and as beautiful. That's the way the bodhisattva sees things. So metta is the key here. Yes, all the other practices of the Dharma, but metta bhavna, it's such an important practice. A lot of people find it a difficult practice, I'm not quite sure why, but a lot of people have real difficulties with it. Usually they get a bit hung up about the first stage of the practice. You know, I don't like myself, I feel bad, I've got a low self-opinion, which is a really sort of sad, you know, sort of state of affairs, and people get really tripped up by this. But Sangharakshita in the seminar says, well, why? Why be like that? Look at you. Look how glorious you are. You are the expression of millions and millions of years of evolution. What an amazing achievement. And actually, you don't really have to do anything to justify your existence in any way. You can just sit there and enjoy being a human being. It's really, really important in the first stage of the metta bhavana. Don't feel you have to love yourself. That can be a bit self-defeating. I remember somebody who didn't like themselves very much and their experience was very painful. They decided that they'd devote 50 minutes a day to the first stage of the metta bhavana, and then wondered why they were getting even more depressed. You know, frankly, if I spent 50 minutes thinking about myself, you know, completely, I'd go a bit mad, I think. You know, that would, you know, get a break, you know, think about your friends and so on. But anyway, but the thing is, this human existence in itself is extraordinarily precious. Yes, there might be all sorts of problems in our life that have happened to us, but the basic kind of living experience, if you can just get back to appreciating that, you know, you're really on the path. You know, just the sheer fact of sitting there breathing, of feeling that sense of awareness that we have in abundance, actually, as human beings. This wonderful self-reflexive consciousness, this sense apparatus, you know, where we can touch and smell and see and think and reflect. Here we are. That's extraordinary. You know, we don't have to kind of do anything, you know, to make that better. It's a start. That's not the end, by the way. That's not the end of the path. That's the beginning. It's the beginning of metta. It's the beginning of metta. Waking up to the preciousness of our human existence and the potential that we have to unfold in the direction of enlightenment is the key to getting a sense of the preciousness of the life in others. You know, because we have that sense of preciousness, but actually everybody else has that sense of preciousness. We feel that we're very important in life, even if we find life very difficult. We're very important to ourselves. Well, everybody else in this room is very, very important to themselves. So why not reach out, step out from our own sense of the preciousness of ourselves to imaginatively identify with the preciousness of others? And really sort of love that. You know, really connect with that and feel, if you like, the life in others. This is the key to wisdom. This is the key to going forward in the Dharma life. So metta bhavana. Really, you know, really think about, well, don't just think about metta bhavana, do the metta bhavana. But really really reflect on that as a practice, as a key to developing wisdom and living the Dharma life. I think that'd be a very good thing to follow up in the groups. You know, have a bit of a talk about the metta bhavana in your life. What's it doing? Is it doing anything? Can you make more of it? In what way can it lead to wisdom, to seeing things as they really are, seeing others as they really are? So yes, that's a really important preparatory practice for the perfection of wisdom. It's also the end point of the perfection of wisdom. But let's move on. Let's move on to the next verses. So these verses are really describing, it's really about the Buddha and his disciples. And it uses an image. So the rivers all in this Rose Apple Island, the Rose Apple Island, Jambudvipa, is India. Roughly corresponds with India. Which caused the flowers, so the rivers which caused the flowers to grow, the fruits, the herbs and trees, they all derive from the might of the king of the Nagas, from the dragon residing in Lake Anupatapta, his magical power. So a little bit of Indian mythology here. So rain and rivers come from dragons, come from the Naga kings living in a lake in the Himalayas. I'm not saying that, that's the tradition. Rain and rivers and water, they're not caused by sort of, you know, the scientific things that we read about. In ancient India, they come from these serpent deities, the Nagas, the great Nagas, the great dragons and snakes that live in the rivers and lakes. They make the waters flow properly. That's why it was very important. Naga worship back in Indian tradition is so important, because they bring the rains. They keep the droughts away. Very different way of talking from our modern way of talking. So it comes from the magical power of this great Naga, this great dragon, his Anubhava. As it's called, is Anubhava, which means something like blessing, power. It's a bit like the word Adhisthana. So yes, a very interesting way of speaking. And this is being used as an analogy for the Buddha. Just so, whatever dharma, whatever teaching the disciples of the Jinnah, the Buddha, teach, whatever they skillfully explain about the spiritual life, the Dharma life, which leads to the fullness of bliss, and the fruit of this fullness of bliss, this all comes from the Tathagata. It all comes from the Buddha. So, yes, you might have disciples of the Buddha teaching, but actually, it comes from the Buddha. For whatever the Jinnah, the Buddha, has taught, who is the guide to the Dharma, his disciples, if they're genuine disciples, have been well trained in his Dharma. And from the direct experience that's come from their training, they teach. Their teaching comes from the might, the Anubhava of the Buddhas, and not their own power. So this needs a bit of explanation. So it's likening the Buddha, as if the Buddha, if you like, is in the great lake, the great ocean of the Dharma. And his disciples have trained in the Buddha's teaching. And through that great training in the teaching, through practicing the precepts, practicing meditation, through studying very deeply what the Buddha has to say, they then have a direct experience of that teaching, and then they teach. But it doesn't come from them. It comes from the Buddha. It comes from the magical power, the blessing of the Buddha. This is not easy for us to understand, because we prize in the West originality. There's a sort of cult of originality, which these days is actually more about novelty than genuine originality. We find it very hard to understand that in you know, traditional, actually not just traditional Buddhist cultures, but traditional societies generally, it's much more, if you like, it's not just polite, it's more than that, but there's much more, as it were, kudos, much more authority, if you like, you're much more respected if your teaching is coming out of faithfully following the tradition, and even being very, very clear that what you're teaching really does derive from the lineage of teachers going back to the Buddha. That gives a teaching far more pedigree and respect than saying, well, it's come out of my own kind of original thinking and so on and so forth. What we're talking about, I guess, is really immersing ourselves in the Dharma as it's come to us. Really immersing ourselves in that. And it's that you turn into a living experience. So I was saying the sort of language of direct experience, which is become a bit of a cult these days, in some ways is quite misleading. I'm much more interested in whether or not people have really trained in the Dharma than their direct experience. What have they really studied? Have they really thought and reflected? Have they really practiced the precepts? Have they practiced, you know, the traditional meditations? And is their teaching really related to that? Yes, experience is important. You know, that making it a living experience is important, but that living experience must be informed from a training. I suppose the analogy would be my friend Aloka, who's done all these sort of paintings for us. When you talk to Aloka, and in a way, these are commissions, so this isn't sort of his own work. But when I talk to Aloka, he's somebody who's studied, you know, the great artistic traditions, particularly of the West. You go into his room and he's got a bookshelves of the great painters. You know, there's, you know, Rembrandt, Vermeer, Picasso, Braque, and, you know, many painters I've never heard of before, and sculptors. And it's quite obvious that he's sort of really, you know, soaked himself in those traditions, as well as studying, you know, Buddhist iconography. And he went to art school in the day where you had to really, really train. You really had to learn how to draw and master the different sort of mediums that were there. He went into art school when he was a teenager. And it's quite obvious that he's coming out of this this training and of soaking himself in the tradition. And anything sort of emerging from that, anything sort of fresh, is coming out on the back of that. So what we're trying to do in terms of our Buddhist practice, our Buddhist training, is really immerse ourselves in the tradition to the extent that we can, you know, patiently going more deeply into it, and then we make that into a living experience. And when we communicate the Dharma, if we're ever in that position, we make it clear, you know, where we sort of stand in it, that we're still sort of beginners. We're still learning, we're still finding our way, but as we understand it, this is what the Buddha's teaching actually is. And actually that can be very, very powerful. There's the famous story of Shariputra, the one of the Buddha's senior great Arahant disciples. How did he come to the Dharma? He saw an earlier disciple of the Buddha named Ashvajit, and he was really struck by Ashvajit's countenance, how bright he seemed and how mindful he was. And he said to him, who is your teacher? What does he teach? This is a very important Indian greeting among those who've gone forth. Who is your teacher? What does he teach? Ashvajit said, well, I'm still a beginner. I'm still learning. But what I do know is that though my teacher is the great Shramana, the Buddha, and he teaches those things which arise from a cause. The Buddha has shown their origination. He's also showed the ending of those causes and conditions. He said it much more succinctly and better than that. And just hearing that provoked in Shariputra an insight, and he became irreversible from enlightenment. Just that from a beginner disciple of the Buddha. Just that phrase. So, and it's very, very interesting. Ashwajit is saying, well, I'm just learning. This is what my teacher has taught me. And the Dharma has that power to change people. So it's much more important that we rely upon the Buddha and the Dharma and our teachers than we rely so much on our direct experience. I remember once I went to see Sangharakshita when I was having a bit of a sort of crisis. I was sort of deploring the fact that my own personal experience of the Dharma was so sort of feeble, particularly in meditation. And I was sort of wondering, well, given how shallow my experience is, should I, and I do so much Dharma work, should I stop doing Dharma work? And he said, well, yes, it would probably help if you had deeper insight. If you had insight and if you had deeper experience, but nobody would know if you had it, if you were communicating the Dharma to them, and you're not going to tell them that you have insight, are you? And so I thought that was an interesting one. Nobody's going to know. What you need to rely upon is the Dharma. That's what's important. He said, I've known people gain insight from a bad exposition of the Four Noble Truths. That's how powerful the Dharma could be. And he said, you should see yourself more as a sort of medium for the Dharma. He said, that's the way I've seen myself. That's the way I've seen what my work is. It's to introduce people to the Dharma. It's not about going on about your own experience. It's about giving the Dharma to people so that they connect with something bigger. Of course, if your own experience can illustrate that, so much the better. But the main thing is people connect with the Buddha and the Dharma. They connect with his anubhava, his force, his power, his blessing. So yes, train in the Dharma deeply. Yes, that becomes a sort of direct experience. And yes, pass it on, share it with other people. But make sure that you're connecting people with the Dharma as something bigger than you. We are getting nearer to the perfection of wisdom, but are there any questions or points you want to raise before I move into the next bit? Oh, what a shame you're so silent. I'm really going to have to do it now, aren't I? So, Edward Conser calls this section the basic teachings. So here we are, boys. The basic teachings. No wisdom can we get hold of. No highest perfection. No bodhisattva. No thought of enlightenment either. When told of this, if not bewildered and in no way anxious, a bodhisattva courses in the well-gone's wisdom. So this is the first teaching of the perfection of wisdom. No wisdom can we get hold of. No highest perfection. No bodhisattva. No thought of enlightenment. That's the first thing. So in some ways this comes as a bit of a... Well, imagine it. There you are. You've turned up for a teaching on the perfection of wisdom. Let's try to sort of maybe picture the scene. You've heard that the Buddha's going to teach. He says he's going to lighten up and gladden people with the perfection of wisdom. You're all sitting there waiting for the teaching. And then he says, no prajna, no wisdom, no highest perfection. In other words, no perfection of wisdom, because that's the highest perfection. No bodhisattva, no thought of enlightenment. That's going to be quite a shock, I think, or a disappointment. There you are, you've turned up to hear this. You've even roused up your faith and devotion. You've cleared away your defilements. You're sort of alert, listening to your teacher. And says, no wisdom, no highest perfection, no bodhisattva, no thought of enlightenment. God, what would you really sort of... I can't really think of an equivalent. You know, maybe if you came here to Padmaloka, you know, and last night, instead of us giving you this big introduction, we just said, actually, there's not going to be a weekend.
on the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhists. We're not going to have one. You know, we just negated everything. I mean, I suspect you'd be a bit freaked. I think you'd probably be a bit freaked out. I think you probably would be a bit bewildered and anxious if we talk like that. And we meant it. You know, fortunately, we haven't got the balls to, whoops, to do that particular experiment. So I remember on one occasion, my dear friend Arlo Kerr, again, we were doing this retreat called the Mythic Context. It's in one of the retreats we do in the ordination training, where you're doing loads and loads of prostrations to the refuge tree, visualizing this great tree of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and chanting, and, you know, in the midst of this retreat, doing lots of puja and meditation, and you're really sort of going for it. Tremendous atmosphere. And Alaka got up, he was giving a talk, and he said, I was just talking to Banti on the phone, he just phoned up, Sangharakshita on the phone, and he said, it's all a big mistake. All this is a big mistake. You know, there isn't, you know, we shouldn't be bothering with all this. And, you know, there is no refuge tree and all the rest of it. And, well, he did it in such a straight way. I mean, some people were really sort of shocked. I mean, one particular order member was absolutely furious. Very interesting. How can you talk like that? And then he said, sorry, it's just a joke. But in a way, it was quite a good moment. Just a sort of check, just to sort of, you know, trip us up a bit, just to get out of the habitual way in which we're sort of thinking about the particular grasping that we brought to what we were doing. It kind of refreshed us. It was a bit of a shock just in that moment. So how can we understand what's going on here? Of course, first thing you have to understand, as I said at the beginning, the Buddha is talking to the four assemblies of monks and nuns and laymen and laywomen, people who are committed to the Dharma. So the assumption, you know, there are people who are really training, really committed to the Buddhist life. They're practicing the precepts, they're meditating, they're studying, you know, they're really thinking in terms of wisdom. They've probably even got some feeling for the bodhicitta, you know, they've roused up this great intention to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. You know, they're immersed in the practice very, very strongly. So, in a way, unless we're doing this, we can't understand that this teaching. Unless we care about the Dharma really very, very deeply, and we've made it central to our lives, we can't really get this. We don't understand this. We'll take it intellectually in the wrong way, and we'll think, well, actually, Buddhism, living the Dharma life, doesn't really matter. You know, which is a sort of terrible curse of sort of modern Buddhism, I think. You know, that people, in a way, have access to these kinds of teachings far too soon. You know, you know, like that Zen story, if you see the Buddha on the road, you should kill him. That is absurd for us. It's totally meaningless. Because we don't actually have any devotional reverence to the Buddha yet. You know, that only works within a highly developed Buddhist culture. Does that have any real meaning? And it doesn't really have any meaning for us. At the same time, I think there is something to say about this. Something that we can make use of in our practice now, wherever we are. So let's just take this first thing. No wisdom can we get hold of. No prajna can we get hold of. No highest perfection. So no prajna paramita can we get hold of. No wisdom can we get hold of. So when we take up encounter Buddhism, the Buddhist life, we're presented with the notion of enlightenment, the ideal of enlightenment. We're get the idea that if we see things as they are, if we see with wisdom, we'll be liberated, we'll be happy, we'll be irreversible, we'll be saved, everything will be fine and straightforward, and so on and so forth. That might be a way of orientating ourselves and a start in our spiritual life, but the great danger is that we turn that into an object to grasp after, an experience to have, that we pull towards ourselves without any real attempt to transform ourselves. You see this particularly with people into meditation. You see people sometimes using a lot of willpower in meditation to have a particular kind of experience. Maybe when they first came along, when they were a beginner, they had that wonderful, fresh beginner's mind. And there's a kind of opening up, and they enter dhyana. You know, but then, having had that experience, they want it again, and again, and again. And they sort of try and force themselves to get that particular experience. That, in the end, is self-defeating. Sangha actually gave a wonderful lecture. It was the first lecture I heard of his life, called Enlightenment as Experience and as Non-Experience. And he went into this whole area of the way we try to grasp after spiritual experience. We experience our life, we feel our life is very empty, meaningless. We come across sort of spiritual teachings and we try to grasp after an experience that comes from, say, a great teacher and promises eternal salvation. In the end, that becomes self-defeating. He said you can even grasp after the perfection of wisdom, but if you do it without the necessary preparation, you can end up going a bit nuts. You can end up going a bit mad, because you're not understanding what's really involved in Dharma life. Because in the end, wisdom, the highest perfection, the term bodhisattva, the term thought of enlightenment, bodhicitta, they don't stand for anything within the framework of subject and object. They're words which transcend the whole grasper-grasped duality. They're pointing to something that is beyond that way of approaching things. And in our lives, our whole experience is vitiated by this grasper and grasped duality. That's the way we live our lives. You know, having and getting and holding on to and pushing away. And we import that into our Dharma life. So we try to grasp hold of wisdom. We try to grasp hold of this experience and that experience. That in the end is self-defeating. There is no wisdom to get hold of. There is no highest perfection to get hold of. There is no bodhicitta to get hold of or bodhisattva to get hold of. We have to start again. We have to think differently about the Dharma life. And I'd really recommend that lecture, Enlightenment is Experience and is Non-Experience, because he comes back to a different way of thinking. Stop thinking about experience. Think of Dharma life in entirely different ways. So he proposes, think of it in terms of growth, of transformation. Don't think about grasping onto something. Instead, really come back to the fact that what the Buddha teaches is the transformation of consciousness. You know, living in terms of wisdom isn't about reaching out to get something and to put it into yourself. It's about sitting with yourself, facing up to yourself, and doing the necessary work to purify your mind of craving and grasping, to develop qualities like metta and so on. And in that way, you experience your life as growing and expanding and ripening and opening up. Then wisdom will, as it were, quite naturally emerge. You won't be trying to get it. It will be sort of dawning. It will be happening. Throughout this text, by the way, you keep getting these verses where it talks about the bodhisattva coursing in perfect wisdom, but having no notion that he's coursing in perfect wisdom. So it's really interesting. There isn't that horrible sort of self-consciousness. I'm a bodhisattva. I'm wise. I'm irreversible. I have attainment. That's not there. There's just this natural, creative functioning. He knows that he has an effect. He's aware of his effect. But there isn't that sort of sense of any kind of personal attainment. No interest in that whatsoever. All there is the immersion in the Dharma life. There's this phrase that Konza
translates that Bodhisattva courses in the well gone's wisdom. The word for course is charya, as in dharmachari, the name of our ordination. Our ordination is that we are coursers in the Dharma. Charya means literally to walk or to practice. You walk in the Dharma, you practice in the Dharma. So it's a very lovely word. But coursing I rather like. It's as if what the perfection of wisdom really is if you like, a vast ocean in which the Bodhisattva is sort of swimming. A vast ocean that comes from the teaching of the Buddha, which the Bodhisattva is immersed in, and in that he's doing the work of bringing the Dharma to others quite sort of naturally and spontaneously, without that sort of horrible kind of self-consciousness that keeps him apart from others. So no wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection, no Bodhisattva. Again, it's sort of, like I say, this one of the things we need to rid ourselves of when we practice the Dharma is a sort of this weird kind of self-consciousness. I am following the path. I am doing this. I have this attainment. I am struggling with this, that and the other. You know, we can really make heavy weather of our Dharma life. I have this problem. And all of it at root is egotism. All of it is self-grasping. All of it is to do with making ourselves feel more self-important in our practice. We've got to lose that. And it's more like, hey, isn't this amazing? I have a precious human existence. Remarkable. You know, I live in a time of enormous freedom, actually. You know, I know we tend to go on about all the problems in the world at the moment, and you know, I don't want to minimize those, but look at it. You know, you can actually go away from a weekend and practice the Dharma. You can't do that in some countries. You can get away. We've got time, we've got leisure, opportunity and freedom to practice, you know, to do something. So you've got this precious human life, so why not really unfold that? Why not develop that? Why not live that? Why not, you know, make that happen, rather than dwelling on all the difficulties, all the sort of lack that's there, and try to get something in Buddhism to make you feel better. So it's much more that we've got to have this sense of the Dharma life as something unfolding, something growing, that we live with others, that we share with others, that we're moving in this, as it were, as I say, this Dharma ocean, coursing in this Dharma notion. When we have that kind of feeling, that comes closer to the life of the perfection of wisdom. That comes nearer to it, I think. I mean, you know, I don't really know what the perfection of wisdom is, not at all, but I sense it's much, much more like that. I remember when I met Dada Rinpoche, Sangharakshita's teacher, whose relics we have in the stupa out here, a portion of them. Sangharakshita regarded Dada Rinpoche as a bodhisattva, a living bodhisattva. Great Tibetan Lama, who gave up on, you know, in a way, having a place within the hierarchy of Tibetan Buddhism. He remained a monk and devoted his life to running a school for Tibetan refugees in Kalimpong. And in a way had to sort of live a bit separately from the politics of the Tibetan world, which is pretty awful, actually. And just devoting himself not just to his life of meditation and study, and this is a man who did 4 hours of practice in the morning and 4 hours in the evening every day before he spent the rest of the day working in his school with these Tibetan refugees and as well as communicating the Dharma. When I went to see Rinpoche, one of the things that struck me was his naturalness. Immensely learned man, you know, really, you know, a very, very high ranking geshe in the Tibetan tradition, you know, incredibly learned, a yogi, a meditator, incredibly capable. And yet I felt I was with somebody who was really quite childlike
in their sense of wonder, in their sense of a genuine sort of humility, not in the sense of, you know, I'm a terrible person and all that sort of thing and I'm really lowly. I remember I thought, well, I'm with a Tibetan Lama, he's my teacher's teacher, I must give him a white scarf, that's what you do, and do a full length prostration, which, you know, so I threw myself on the floor. He was just incredibly concerned that I didn't damage myself in the most sort of natural way. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't at all concerned with the sort of customs of Tibetan Buddhism. And when I was showing these not very good photos of the different Buddhism bodhisattvas that I meditated on, he treated them as if they were the most sort of sacred relics, you know, that you could find, putting them to his head. So there was this sense of the sort of naturalness of the Dharma life, this sense of someone really living in this sphere of wisdom. But there was no sense of any kind of self-consciousness, no sense of I'm an important person or anything like that. Somebody just completely immersed in Dharma, immersed in communication, immersed in wanting to talk and communicate and treating me with real respect, even though he was so much greater than I could possibly ever be. But this sense of being respected as a human being, that is what I think the perfection of wisdom looks like. That's what it looks like in behavior. Yes, it's a life which is without egolessness. You're seeing that there isn't any essence in anything. There isn't any essence in the words wisdom, bodhisattva, bodhicitta, and so on and so forth. But what that leads to is a life of complete selflessness. That is the life of complete selflessness. So, these are my attempts to understand these opening words. It is very interesting, though, that it said, no wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection, no bodhisattva, no bodhicitta either. When told of this, if not bewildered in, and in no way anxious, a bodhisattva causes in the world gone's wisdom. This business of bewilderment and anxiety comes up again and again in the perfection of wisdom teachings. It's quite interesting. It's quite clear that this is regarded as a profound teaching that's being delivered. And if you don't get it and you feel bewildered and troubled and anxious, well, that means you haven't understood. You haven't got it. You know, because, you know, it's going to be a bit disorientating to hear this kind of teaching presented to you. Perhaps another way of looking at this in terms of Dharma practice is when you read books on the Dharma, they lay out the path very, very clearly. I think Buddhism is fantastic because of its clarity. You know, you get this wonderful sense of how the path, you know, you practice ethics, you practice meditation, you enter the different dhyana stages, you see things as you are, as they are, you become irreversible, you go up the sort of stages and steps, and hey presto, you're enlightened. The reality of living the Dharma life isn't like that. It really isn't like that. That's very, very good for purposes of exposition. But when you're in the midst of it, it really doesn't seem like that. It can see, you know, because things arise which really challenge you. I mentioned before the tea break my experience of teaching the Dharma in India and the different things that sort of came to me there. You know, the sort of shock coming from life that was presented to me. It was, you know, all my sort of Dharmic categories were very, really, really challenged. In other words, that there's a disparity between the way things are laid out intellectually and your actual experience of living the Dharma life. And that's a very, very important experience. You know, all the time, if you like, as we practice the Dharma, things will be flowing in that will be challenging our narrow and therefore false understanding of the Dharma. Inevitably, you take hold of the Dharma from a particular side. in a particular aspect. That's good. It gets us going. It gets us started. But as we go on in our experience,
as we go on in our practice, experience will flood in and it will blow away our partial understanding. That's not the fault of the Dharma. That's the fault of our limited understanding and experience. So that's perhaps another way of seeing it. We're constantly having to kind of redefine what it is that we're doing as we practice. There's a lovely poem by Sangharakshita where he says, some people think that the Buddha way is like a white road with signposts on the way saying Nirvana in half a mile and then you'll be at the Peace Hotel, good pilgrims. But in the second part of the poem he says, but those who know the Dharma inly wise know that the Dharma is a hacked path roughly made through densest jungle. That's more like it. That's more like how we approach the perfection of wisdom. And it's 1 o'clock and time for lunch.